Blog Talk Radio. This is the EWN Radio Network.
And so this is not the time to be shy. It's like my mission to make bowel symptoms be as ordinary and matter of fact as every other part of the body. You know, people can talk about their diabetes, they can talk about their asthma, but people tend not to talk about their bowel symptoms.
Places, everybody, places. We're starting in 3, 2.
It's time for Life Interrupted Radio, a show dedicated to practical skills for your mind, body, and soul. We're hoping we'll go in one ear and stay there. Here's the host of the show, Sharon Saylor.
Welcome to this special series we're featuring here on Life Interrupted Radio, where we look at the rise of autoimmune disorders. The NIH estimates nearly 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder. To put that in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. You'll be as surprised as I was to find out what autoimmune entails. I brought together top experts that range from doctors, specialists, nutritionists, researchers, and even those recovering from autoimmune to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information about autoimmunity and how to live your life uninterrupted. So let's get started. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Life Interrupted Radio. We're continuing our series on autoimmune conditions and how to thrive regardless of your diagnosis. We've heard from wonderful experts so far on a wide variety of topics, and today I have the Dr. Barbara Bolin. And I'm so thrilled to have her because she's an expert in IBS and FODMAP diet. We're going to get into that in just a minute, but I just want to sort of tease you on where we're going. It's my weekend. I hope it's the start of yours. And as always, I'm curled up here. Yeah, I'm here with my favorite white jasmine tea. You know, sometimes I don't have a chance to drink it during the interview, but I just love smelling it, if nothing else, as I'm sitting here with it. What are you curled up with tonight as you listen into Dr. Barbara Bolin? And we're going to be talking about IBS. Now, if you don't know what that stands for, it stands for irritable bowel syndrome. And yeah, we're going to be talking about some of the, I'll put in air quotes, you know, dirtier parts of life and how we deal with them. But that is an important part of our health, our digestive system from top to bottom. And Barbara's going to be talking about that. She is a psychologist, health coach, and health writer, and she specializes in digestive health. She currently serves as the IBS expert for the website about.com. Sign up for her because she sends, I don't know how many times, I'll have to ask her how many times, but it's a couple of times a week I get things from About with new information about IBS, and I just love to read her articles there on about.com. And she offers online training on the low FODMAP diet at everythinglowfodmap.com. Now, that's kind of a long URL. I'll have that in the blog for you as well over at lifeinterruptedradio.com. She is the author of IBS, 365 Tips for Living Well, Breaking the Bonds of Irritable Bowel Syndrome, and the co-author of the Everything Guide to the Low FODMAP Diet and IBS Chat, Real Life Stories and Solutions. As you can tell, she's just going to be a wealth of knowledge. We'll get into more of her bio in a little bit later, but let's bring her on right away so we have plenty of time to find out all about IBS, our digestive health, and what the heck is a FODMAP? So welcome, Barbara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I have, over the years, off and on, had IBS, and then it seems to go away, and then it's all of a sudden, maybe I'll just sort of put in the air quotes, out of the blue, it comes back into my life. Let's give a little bit of explanation of what IBS is for people if they haven't ever heard about it.
So IBS is a digestive disorder in which people experience sort of chronic problems with their intestines. The symptoms are abdominal pain, which could just be mild and mildly irritating or could be really severely painful and debilitating. Chronic problems with going to the bathroom, so it's either urgent episodes of diarrhea or frustrating episodes of constipation, gas, bloating. Sometimes people with IBS have just a whole other array of symptoms throughout their body that they feel is connected to the IBS. But IBS in and of itself really is, you know, related to those chronic intestinal symptoms.
Is IBS considered an autoimmune condition?
As of right now, it is not classified as an autoimmune condition. It's classified as a functional disorder because when your doctor, if you go to the doctor and you're saying you're having all these symptoms, they do all standard tests and nothing shows up on the test to show what's wrong. And so it's really more a disorder of how the system is functioning, as opposed to, for right now, the ability to see any visible inflammation or diseased tissue.
Jen, I know when I was having some of those issues myself, it was frustrating to be able to figure out really what was going on. And as you said, sometimes there's things, other things going on in the body, and you begin to wonder what if it's all one thing or if you have multiple problems going on, which can be so frustrating. What, when you go to the doctor, what are some of the things that you want to take with you when you ask about, okay, could this be IBS, other than, you know, I'm having these symptoms of urgent going or constipation? Are there things that you need to be aware of, or like keeping a food journal so they have that in advance or anything like that?
Well, first of all, I would just recommend always that people should write down their questions ahead of time, because it's always a little scary to go to the doctor. You're very nervous. You're having these symptoms. You're afraid of what you're going to hear. And the other thing is, because the symptoms, you know, have to do with bathroom issues, people tend to be more embarrassed or shy about discussing those things. So writing down the questions just sort of neutralizes some of that shyness. You can just kind of get the question out, because it is really important for doctors to know the full range of symptoms that you're experiencing. And so this is not the time to be shy. It's like my mission to make bowel symptoms be as ordinary and matter of fact as every other part of the body. You know, people can talk about their diabetes, they can talk about their asthma, but people tend not to talk about their bowel symptoms. Absolutely, I would recommend writing out the questions ahead of time. And then in terms of what's important to tell the doctor, I think that was your question. Again, you want to just be really open and frank and matter of fact with the symptoms that you're experiencing. I don't know that doctors are going to have a lot of time to look at a food diary, but I think just telling them your experience, what you're experiencing, should be enough.
Great. Now, let's go back to the food diary, though. Does your diet play into IBS, or is it some other cause for the condition?
Well, they don't really know what causes IBS, other than for some people, they can kind of trace it back to a severe intestinal illness. And when I first started writing about IBS, doctors really said food had nothing to do with it, which was in such contrast to people's experience, where they believe that, you know, absolutely food, you know, I eat lettuce and I'm running to the bathroom. So it's really only more recently that doctors are slowly starting to acknowledge that food has a role, and the advent of that FODMAP diet that you mentioned, that has really brought food front and center when talking about IBS. So FODMAPs don't cause IBS, but they do cause the symptoms of IBS.
We'll talk about the FODMAP in just a second, but I wanted just to get a clarification that your example of lettuce was just an example. It doesn't cause people running to the bathroom and everyone, correct?
Oh, no. Right. So for one person, it's lettuce. For one person, it's whenever they have pizza. For another person, it's when they have fried food. So again, for everybody's different, and that's one of the reasons why IBS is always so puzzling. It's because it presents itself so differently, not only so differently from person to person, but as you know for yourself, it can present so differently from one day to the next or from one year to the next.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a very puzzling disorder.
And it was frustrating. And for me, I found my stress level had played a lot into it as well. Besides any food sensitivities I had, I noticed that at certain times it would get worse and I would reflect and go, my stress level is fairly high right now, too.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Right. So stress exacerbates the symptoms. Hormonal changes, particularly for women, can exacerbate symptoms. It's such a puzzle as to what's actually the underlying causes. Is it hormonal? Is it neurotransmitters? Is it stress? Is it food? Is it bacteria? You know, I think that as, you know, the newest areas of research have to do with the role of bacteria in our large intestines, and it may be that the bacteria is sort of connected to all those things, that the bacteria interact with the food, or the bacteria get changed when you're under stress, or the bacteria affect the neurotransmitters and the hormones. Like, that may end up being the unifying principle among all these possible reasons why a person has IBS.
So that brings up a question about this new, I guess it's not new, but I'm recently hearing more and more about it, and it's called SIBO. Is that along the same lines of this, what could possibly be an indication or a cause of IBS?
What they're starting to acknowledge is that for some people, SIBO may be what is the problem. And for your listeners who don't know what that is, so it's small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So the way that your body is designed, there's supposed to be very few bacteria in your small intestine as opposed to your large intestine, which is like teeming with bacteria. And they're starting to see that for some people, the small intestine has become, you know, there's many more bacteria within that area of your body than are supposed to be there. And again, that could be the result of stress. It could be the result of a bacterial illness. The treatment for SIBO is a little bit different than IBS. It can be treated with specific types of antibiotics. But here's the deal. Although some doctors swear that SIBO is playing a large role for many cases of IBS, it's still relatively controversial, and there are some doctors who really still minimize and don't really believe that that's what's really going on. It's funny that it's still controversial.
It's interesting to me where the doctors are all still trying to decide, and where that leaves us, the common, I'll use in air quotes, the common sufferer here, to try and sort it all out. Oh my goodness, it's amazing how misunderstood our digestive system is.
Absolutely. I will give a little like rule of thumb for SIBO. And that is, if your symptoms are a lot of gas and bloating, and if you tend to experience your IBS symptoms sort of within the first hour and a half after eating, like that first 90 minutes, it is possible that SIBO might be going on. And the way that it's diagnosed is actually through a breath test, where you drink a solution, and then they test the level of certain gases in your breath a short time after drinking the solution. So if that's the way your IBS is presenting, then definitely talk to your doctor about it and see about getting tested. Because as I said, there is an antibiotic treatment for SIBO that can be effective.
Which to me is always counterintuitive, thinking that I'd been told that sometimes you can destroy the balance of the good bacteria versus bad bacteria in your gut if you take antibiotics for a bacterial infection otherwise in your body or somewhere else.
That is such a great question, and you're absolutely right. Most antibiotics absolutely can really disrupt the bacterial balance within your large intestine, so that definitely is a problem. But for the treatment of SIBO, these are specific antibiotics that get to the small intestine intact and therefore able to wipe out any bacteria within the small intestine.
Well, thank you for clarifying that, because you know, every time you take an...
You always wondered about that, right?
Yeah, every time you take an antibiotic, the doctor, you know, take a probiotic or eat yogurt or something like that along those lines.
Exactly. And that's good, and that is very, very good advice. So just remember that with SIBO, it's a very specific type of antibiotic.
Okay, great. Let's take a quick commercial break, because I know we're a little ahead of schedule here, but I want to jump into Barbara's work on FODMAP, because it's very fascinating to me, the FODMAP diet and the way you eat, how it affects you physically in so many ways, just beyond IBS too. So we'll be back in just a moment.
Life Interrupted Radio will return after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more. This episode is brought to you by mindfulnessinactionbook.com. To get your free 4-minute guided meditation to relax, refresh, and renew in just 4 minutes, and who doesn't have 4 minutes? Stop by mindfulnessinactionbook.com now. This guided meditation is in handy MP3 format, so you can use it anywhere, anytime. Download it now at mindfulnessinactionbook.com.
Do you want to be a better leader, have better relationships, become more self-aware, be a better communicator? Hi, I'm Sharon Saylor, best-selling author, professional speaker, and executive coach, and my life passion is empowering professionals to be the best that they can be. After years of working with professionals, I've discovered the 7 things nobody is telling you that can cost you your clients, sales, and even your career. And I want to give it to you free. You've heard my show, you know my passion, and maybe we'll be working together sooner rather than later. So go grab this ebook now to find out the 7 things that's costing you big time over at SharonSaylor.com/radio gift. Welcome back to Life Interrupted Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Saylor from lifeinterruptedradio.com. We're here with Dr. Barbara Bolin. She's a psychologist, health coach, and health writer specializing in digestive health. She's the IBS expert for the website about.com, and she also offers online training in the low FODMAP diet at everythinglowfodmap.com. Now, we've been talking about IBS, digestive health, SIBO, all sorts of things like that. But one of the things that fascinated me as I started to explore recovery from autoimmune conditions was food sensitivities and how that played into, or if it played into, autoimmune conditions. And I discovered the FODMAP. Now, Barbara, I love the FODMAP, but in all honesty, I found it kind of tough to stick to. So let's talk about why the FODMAP and why it's so important to stick to it when you're in working through IBS or other conditions where it seems appropriate. Let's describe what is the FODMAP. I know that it comes, I got this wonderful download where it had, I believe, four columns of what was the low FODMAP and what was high FODMAP. Let's first off define what FODMAP is. It's not just a food map missing an O.
Right. So a FODMAP is an acronym. It's called FODMAP because of the words that go into that. So they're fermentable, osmotic, and then they're disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. But what they really are just carbohydrates found in regular food. And most of your listeners probably already know a couple of the FODMAPs. Lactose is a FODMAP. Fructose is a FODMAP. And what researchers have found is that for whatever reason, people who have IBS, when they eat foods that are high in these carbohydrates, high in FODMAPs, they are more likely to have symptoms. And so what they devised, these are researchers out of Monash University in Australia, and they devised a diet where people restrict themselves to only low FODMAP foods for a certain amount of time, an elimination phase, and then slowly reintroduce each FODMAP type back in to their diet to see which ones they can tolerate and which ones they still have difficulty with. Now, the amazing thing about this diet, so again, when I first started writing about IBS, doctors said food had nothing to do with it. Also, when I first started writing about IBS, there are very few effective treatments. But the FODMAP diet, it's hard and it's challenging, but it's so effective. The research is showing that when people stick to an elimination phase under the supervision of a trained dietary professional, 75% of IBS people with IBS will get significantly better. And in my own work with clients, by significantly meaning they feel normal, sometimes normal for the first time in years and years and years. But it's definitely tricky. Why is it tricky? Because these FODMAPs, these carbohydrates, are in lots of foods that we eat. So one of the FODMAPs is fructans, which is found in wheat. Now, wheat, in a typical American diet, wheat is everywhere. You know, it's even in ketchup now, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
So garlic and onions, which are typically used in most restaurants for flavoring, those are high FODMAP ingredients. So the tricky thing about being on the diet is really figuring out what you can eat and still follow the guidelines of the diet.
It is a tricky diet to follow, but I did follow it, and in testament to it, I did feel much better. I did find, though, that it was hard if you travel, which I do a lot, or you like to go out with friends. It's a hard one to stick with on the and going off of it just a little bit, thinking I can cheat, doesn't work.
Right. So here's what happens often in the real world. So for some people, they're able to stick for that low FODMAP elimination period and really feel better and then slowly reintroduce and really get a sense of which ones they can handle, which ones they can't. But often in the real world, I see two major benefits of the diet. Number one is it gives people back a sense of control. Like you kind of know, well, if I cheat, I might have a tough time tomorrow. As opposed to it used to be, I have no idea when this IBS is going to hit. Some days it's better, sometimes it's worse. Sometimes I eat this and I'm fine, and sometimes I eat this and I'm not fine. So it does kind of just gives you more information and helps you to identify which foods get away with and which foods are troublesome. And then the second thing that I love about the FODMAP diet is I really am a holistic health practitioner. I strongly believe in eating lots of fruits and vegetables for health. And most people with IBS are terrified of fruits and vegetables for good reason, because a lot of fruits and vegetables are high in FODMAP, and so when they eat them, they feel worse. So what I love about the FODMAP diet is it gives people a way to reintroduce vegetables and fruits into their diet with the confidence that eating low FODMAP vegetables and fruits, they're going to be able to introduce those into their diet without having to worry about that they're going to get symptomatic.
Yes, I agree with that. And it is interesting, though, that how some of them, as you introduce them, as you go up in, I'll say, into the from the legal up into the ones that are probably going to have more symptoms, some of those that are in the more symptomatic area seem to tolerate fine, and then others you can't. And I always found that interesting, I guess, in my own mind. I thought, okay, if it's on this side of the chart, just stay away from it. But I found that there were certain ones, as I started to reintroduce foods, I could eat from the higher part, and yet there were ones that caused me almost immediate problems.
Right, and that is because not everyone is reactive to every type of FODMAP. There are different FODMAP groups. In the beginning, the diet requires that you kind of restrict all of them. I think that really just kind of gives the gut a chance to heal, reduces some of the population of your not-so-friendly bacteria in your gut. But then the reintroduction, if you do it systematically, then you can kind of figure out, oh, I'm fine with fructose, but I can't handle fructans. And so you might find, oh, there's some fruits I can eat, but there's some vegetables I still have to stay away from.
Now, one of the things that I found interesting was in the fructans, and it said not about wheat. How does this differ from gluten-free or gluten? Gluten-free is sort of all of the talk right now, but these are different than the topic of gluten.
Right. Well, the main distinction is that gluten is a protein and FODMAPs are carbohydrates. The thing is that wheat, again, which is kind of ever so present in our diet, wheat has both the protein gluten and the FODMAP fructan. But many people with IBS do better on a gluten-free diet. But what I want to say is that celiac disease is underdiagnosed in our country. And so anybody who has IBS who's thinking of going gluten-free should absolutely get tested for celiac disease before they go gluten-free, because you need to be eating gluten at the time of testing for the testing to be accurate. And you really need to know whether or not you have celiac disease, because if you have celiac disease, you can't cheat. If you don't have celiac disease, then you may have either a gluten sensitivity, like you're just sensitive to the protein in wheat, or you are reactive to the carbohydrate, the FODMAP fructan in wheat. If you don't have celiac disease, you just have a gluten sensitivity or a sensitivity to the FODMAP, then you can cheat. You're just going to kind of pay the price, but you're not putting your health at high risk.
So I want to get clear on a couple of things here. On one of the things about getting tested for celiac, I didn't know that, so I want to reiterate that you have to be eating gluten at the time of the testing. How much beforehand? Because I know several people that have gone gluten-free, and then they go and get tested, and they say, oh, I'm not celiac. And so I didn't know that. That's really surprising to me. I don't find that anybody has ever told us that before, that you have to be exposing yourself to it before the test.
Right, because the initial test is blood work, and the blood work measures antibodies in the blood. But if you haven't eaten gluten, then your body's not producing those antibodies. Follow?
Right.
The other test for celiac disease, really what's needed for confirmation, is a biopsy of the small intestine. That is really kind of the gold standard. So they do the blood testing sort of as a screening, so that not everybody has to go through the procedure of the biopsy. For the people that you know who went gluten-free and then had the blood work done, that blood work is not accurate. They cannot be sure that they don't have celiac disease.
Right. I have several acquaintances that have been gluten-free for a long time, and then they heard about celiac, and they went and gotten tested, and the results were negative, and they said, oh, I don't have celiac. But how long would you say someone would need to be reintroduced to gluten before they chose to take the blood test again? Is it a long period of time if they've been gluten-free for...
I think the day before the test.
Oh, my goodness, that quick.
Yeah, because if you have celiac disease, the antibiotics are going to, if you eat any gluten, those antibodies are going to kick in.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was that quick.
But if your acquaintances, they're suspecting, if they've been gluten-free for a while and they're still suspecting that they have celiac disease, they really should talk to their doctors. If there are other symptoms of malabsorption, which would indicate that celiac is there, they need to talk to their doctor about getting tested, whether it's the blood work or going for the biopsy.
Right, right. It seems to me as if gluten-free, this idea of gluten-free, I know it's been building for a while, but it seems to me that it's sort of come out of the woodwork or out of the blue very quickly on us, and now everybody's sort of jumping on the bandwagon. Yet when I read the ingredients in a lot of the gluten-free products, I'm not so sure They might help us with the gluten, but my goodness, they sure contain a lot of other things, like the honeys and the fructose and so many of the other things that might cause us other problems.
Right, and the other thing is for manufacturers to make gluten-free products to taste good, yeah, they put in sweeteners and all sorts of other artificial flavorings, chemicals that are not good for you. So the gluten-free diet is not necessarily a healthy diet. Again, it's how you approach it. If you go gluten-free but you still eat lots of vegetables, lots of fruits, non-gluten-containing whole grains, then you can be gluten-free and be a healthy person. But if you go gluten-free and you're eating a lot of gluten-free packaged processed foods, you're not necessarily doing your health any favors.
Oh, I'm glad you bring that up, because I've looked at the back of these packages sometimes and I go, oh, wow, there's as many strange ingredients in this as there are in this other product I'm trying to get not take. It's like...
Exactly. And you're wise to be reading the labels. Everybody should be reading labels.
Well, I've found that if I just stay with things that I have to prepare, like beets or Brussels sprouts or something like that, it's easy for me to do. It's when I start getting into some of the prepared types of dishes that's where I get into trouble, and I don't always understand the list of ingredients. And I figure if I don't understand the list of ingredients, I probably don't want to eat it.
Right, because if you don't understand it, how do we expect our bodies to understand it?
Right, exactly. Now, on the FODMAP, how long should someone stay in the low category before they start to reintroduce some of the things in the moderate category?
So the elimination phase is generally estimated like 2 to 6 weeks. To me, I think 2 weeks is a little short, but the good news about the low FODMAP diet is most people feel better within 2 weeks, so that can kind of keep the motivation for going a little bit longer. So I usually have my clients aim for about 4 weeks, and I just feel like that really just gives the gut a chance to kind of heal and settle down. And then you get much more clear-cut information when you slowly start to introduce the FODMAPs back. But I also want to say this. The research is interesting and hopeful in that when people do the elimination phase, at the end of it, they find that they can tolerate certain foods that they could not tolerate before they did the elimination phase. So just restricting yourself to low FODMAP foods for that elimination phase increases the amount and the variety of foods you'll be able to tolerate when you're through that part of it.
That's fascinating. I just want to reiterate to make sure I heard this correctly. I have some food sensitivities and not true allergies, nothing causing anaphylactics, we'll say, just some sensitivities where I know every time I eat such and such, something goes on. And if I do the low FODMAP for a month, I might just be able to calm everything down to where the sensitivity to that other, maybe it's a moderate FODMAP, and I might be able to eat that now?
If your food sensitivity is due to the FODMAP contents of the food.
Oh, I see.
Right? Foods are not just carbohydrates, right? They're foods are, have lots of different things in them. But if it's IBS, and if you, let's say, have a sensitivity, or you sort of have a sense, I have a sensitivity to fructose, you may find that at the end of the 4 weeks, you can eat a food that's higher in fructose and maybe tolerate it fine. The other thing I just want to point out about the low FODMAP diet, because this is interesting and it kind of answers some questions many people with IBS have, and that is the notion of FODMAP load. And what that has to do with how many FODMAPs you eat at a time together or within the course of a day. And this explains why sometimes somebody can be like, I can have this food one day and be fine, and then have it another day and not be fine. It often has to do with what other foods you've eaten around that particular food, so that bodies can tolerate maybe lower levels of fructose but not high levels of fructose, or lower levels of lactose but not high levels of lactose.
Oh, my goodness. I love the FODMAP, and I love how it makes me feel, but I understand why there are times when I would go stick out, oh, I'm just going to eat it. And yes, you're right. I always ended up paying for it. But it's one of those things where it's fantastic, but I have to be honest, it's not that, for me and my lifestyle, it wasn't that easy to stick to. And I think it's tough when you have other members of your family who have, I'll just say, a cast iron gut.
Exactly. Yes. And that is really why it's recommended that it be done under the supervision of a dietary professional. You know, the original diet was, the research was conducted with people working with dietitians. I happen to be a health coach, and I haven't gone through health coach training. I believe that health coaches, with their emphasis on eating a wide variety of foods and a holistically healthy lifestyle, can also absolutely help to support people on a low FODMAP diet so that they have more of a chance to be successful, to stay low FODMAP through that elimination period, to figure out through the challenging phase which are the FODMAPs that give them a problem, and really help them to eat as wide a variety of food as possible. Because as you know with your autoimmune work, right, the wider the variety of plant-based foods that you can get into your diet, there's a lot of healing that can go on within the gut, and then that can have positive effects throughout the body.
It amazes me how much, though, digestive health is underlooked. I remember when I first had my autoimmune condition, I went to a rheumatologist, and it was the very first visit. He said, "So, what have you been doing?" And I kind of went through the list that I had restricted gluten and dairy, and I was eating only organic, you know, the whole list of all the things,
right,
I could think, you know, filtered water. And he looked at me in all seriousness and said, "None of that's going to help." So I looked at him, I said, "Well, I don't think it's going to hurt." And then on to a new rheumatologist, of course.
That's an excellent answer. That's an excellent answer. And I would say that any stories I've heard about people dramatically turning around to autoimmune disease has been because they've made dramatic changes in the foods that they eat and in terms of their self-care. But a similar story, I took my teenage son to the dermatologist with bad acne, and the dermatologist looked at him and said, "Food has nothing to do with acne." I wanted to strangle the man because now, of course, my son is thinking, "Great, I can eat all the McDonald's and all the pizza and all the junk food that I want, and you know, he's going to take care of my skin health." So, yeah, doctors are very slow to come on board in terms of the role of food and health, which is so puzzling to me because all of us, we give such power to a little pill. Like, we think about the effects of a little tiny pill, and then we put foods and chemicals in our bodies all day long, and we say that has nothing to do with how the body's going to function or what symptoms we're going to have. Very puzzling to me, but it's been also eye-opening for me, the whole world of the connection between what we eat and the diseases that we are dealing with.
Oh, me too. Since my diagnosis, that's one of the areas that I've become just very intrigued by. Someone told me when I was first starting down this path of healing and being very, very careful of what I put into my mouth, foods are chemicals too. It's not just that little pill is a chemical, or, you know, you're washing your hands or put a lot of chemicals in the soap or whatever. Foods are actually made up of chemicals as well, so you have to look at it that you, each time you eat, you're changing your chemistry. Are you changing it for the good or are you changing it for the bad? That really helped me understand more about food and diet than just, I think a lot of us look at food as more along the lines of an emotional thing, is support. It tastes good. It feels good. It makes me feel good when I eat it. It's fun to eat with family members, whatever. When I looked at it as, okay, we're just one big chemistry experiment, it seemed
like... Yeah, I love that. I love that, right? And so therefore then food becomes food for healing.
And I think that's the best way I've told my family. I have a lot of lovely family members, but our family was, here, have a cookie, you'll feel better, or having the big Sunday meals with the entire family was very important. And it's sometimes hard for the family that have the iron gut to, like, oh, just, you know, have this. It's Sunday. It's not like Sunday makes a difference.
That's funny. And now, autoimmune is not my area. My area is digestive. I do know about the autoimmune protocol, and since that does require increasing the amount of vegetables and fruits, so for anyone who has an autoimmune disorder who also has IBS, will actually love the FODMAP diet. I don't want to scare anybody off because it's tricky. It's not impossible. And again, using the FODMAP as a tool for a person with autoimmune and IBS, a tool to get those healthy, healing foods into the system, but in a way that your IBS can handle it. Again, don't be afraid of the FODMAP diet. It's a great, great, great tool.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If I'm giving the impression, folks, that it's just something that you have to really make a commitment to and tell friends and family, look, you're going to support me on this. I don't want anybody saying, oh, it's just Sunday. This is my thing. And you get everybody to support you on it. It's actually quite easy because they're just like, we understand, Sharon. This is what you need to do now. And once they have the understanding of that and you get them on board, it works well. It works well. But sometimes you do have to educate those around you who, you know, share meals with you, that type of thing. I am curious, on many of the fruits and vegetables, does it matter on the FODMAP how you prepare them, like steaming them versus roasting them? Or does it the preparation matter at all?
Only as long as you don't prepare them with any high FODMAP ingredients. So, you know, you think of how many meals you make, and they say, you know, cut up onions and garlic and saute in oil and then add everything else, right? But no, the actual method of preparation does not change the FODMAP load of a meal as long as you're not using high FODMAP ingredients in the cooking.
Great to know. Then another question around that is, if you've got digestive problems and like IBS, sometimes people say, oh, raw is the way to go. You should only eat all your fruits and vegetables, you know, raw carrots, don't ever cook them. But then I've been told on the other side that, goodness, if you've got all these digestive upsets and IBS, it's a little easier to digest if you actually cook them. Do you have a point of view on whether you should go raw or cooked?
Most people with IBS will tell you they have a hard time with raw vegetables and that cooking them does make them easier to digest. Then, of course, you talk to raw food people and they say, you know, I went raw and my IBS disappeared. So it's so hard to know with nutrition. I do think that every person is different and every body is different. And I do think, you know, when you go raw, you're eating a very, you know, you're eating a plant-based diet. You're not eating wheat because you can't really eat wheat raw. So I think that there's an overall healing that goes on with a raw diet that helps. But in the real practical world for people who are not, and most of us would not be able to really make the leap to a fully raw diet, I would recommend at least in the beginning until things are settling down that you cook your vegetables.
Fantastic to know. Now, I just want to open it up to what other things would you recommend as we say, okay, IBS, yes, checking off the list here. What other things do you suggest that we know about the FODMAP as we begin to go into it and then knowing how to reintroduce the moderate, and then do we always stay away from the high-level ones?
No. So first of all, I'm going to give a little plug. So Monash University in Australia, they're the ones that came up with this diet. I just want to give them a plug that they have the most amazing app. It's called the Monash University Low FODMAP Diet app. It's so user-friendly. So wherever you are, you're in the store, you're in a restaurant, you're going to prepare a recipe. Even I cannot remember all the FODMAP levels of all the different foods. There's going to be foods. So you just whip out the app, you look up the food, and it will tell you red light, yellow light, or green light. So that is a great...
Oh, fantastic.
Such a great resource. So easy. So what happens is after you've done the elimination phase, and now you're going to reintroduce, you're going to pick one food that contains only one type of FODMAP, and then you eat a small amount of that, like say at the beginning of week, and then you try it again a day later, you try a little bit more the next day. And if you have no reaction, then you can think, okay, I might be good with this particular FODMAP. And then one by one, you test all the different FODMAP types. Once you sort of have a sense of which are the real red light FODMAPs for you, you know, which are the foods that you know you're going to give yourself trouble, what you would do is either just fill most of your diet with foods that are tolerable for you. So they're going to be the green light foods, but they might be some red light foods if they're from the FODMAP group that you know you can tolerate. Then always kind of recommend every few months retest.
Mm.
Or even just every now and then try and include a low level of that red light food. Because again, many high FODMAP foods are really, really good for you. And because life can be confusing, many high FODMAP foods are really good for your gut bacteria. And that is one of the concerns about people staying on the FODMAP diet or just eating low FODMAP for a long period of time, is that you're not getting the prebiotics, those healthy food components that encourage healthy, friendly bacteria in your gut. And so it's kind of always a trial and error, that you always want to kind of be slowly, gradually expanding the range of foods that you can eat.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I can see how you could easily get lured into just, okay, I'm just going to stay in the low, in the green, and just have this, you know,
right,
carrot and chives and cucumber, and that's it for the rest of my life. But it would get pretty boring, actually, if that's all you did. But.
Exactly. And so people, again, my clients that I've worked with, they're eager to get to the challenge stage. They're kind of eager to figure out what they can eat and what they can't eat. And again, they walk away with knowledge, and knowledge gives you that sense of control, and we all want a sense of control, right? We want to know, look, I have a big party I'm going to attend tonight, so I'm going to make sure I kind of stay really safe with my FODMAPs all day long. Or, you know what, it's the weekend, so I'm going to try something on a Friday night. And if I have trouble, well, I'll deal with it because I have a slow day tomorrow. So, again, I love that it gives that sense of control. You know, as one person, one of my clients said, it's almost like, you know, like a gas pedal and a brake, right? You know, how fast do you want to go versus, you know, when do you feel like you need to slow down?
And I'm glad you bring up that sense of control. It's so important as we're healing from anything, whether it's IBS or an autoimmune condition, is being educated on all of your different options, like the FODMAP and what is IBS and everything we've talked about in the autoimmune series as well, because too many times we can hand over all of these things to the healthcare professionals who don't know about us individuals, how we are individuals, about our lifestyles, about our choices. And it's important, I'm glad you bring that up, about being educated about it and taking control of our own health. To me, that's what Life Interrupted Radio's autoimmune series is all about, is being able to take control back of your own health and not giving that part of it away to someone else without being educated and knowing your choices on that. Oh, my goodness. Barbara, this has just been fantastic information for IBS and autoimmune and the FODMAP, bringing in this idea of FODMAP. Thank you so much. How can our listeners get a hold of you and get more information about any of these topics if it's resonated with them?
So it gets a little confusing because I have three separate websites which all offer kind of a different resource. So you mentioned that you get the newsletters from about.com. So on IBS.about.com, there's information on every single aspect you can ever dream of with IBS. That's there. But if you wanted to work with me, either I work with clients either individually or within groups, then you would visit my personal website, Dr. Barbara Bolen, and that's BOLEN.com. On that site, it's very clear how you can connect with me and have a conversation with me, and we could see if we'd be a good fit to work together. And then last, you mentioned it before, the website Everything Low FODMAP, and again, FODMAP is FODMAP.com. What we have on that is resources specifically designed for people on a low FODMAP diet. And the thing that I most want to bring to attention is that I have an e-course up there. So this is a self-paced, self-guided course in which a person can really learn about all the nuts and bolts of the diet, figure out how to get walked through the different phases of the diet, and then we offer some social support as well. So for people who may not have the financial resources to work with me as an individual or group client, or they have no access to a dietitian or health coach in their area who knows IBS and knows the FODMAP diet, the e-course is just a great, great resource.
And it's a great resource as well just to educate yourself. So when you do go to your health coach or your nutritionist or your health practitioner, you come with some basic knowledge and come with better questions for them.
Exactly. Great plug. Thank you.
Yeah, I love it. I took it and I found it very helpful in getting all the basic questions where, and then I could take the, oh, but what about very things specific to me, to my healthcare practitioner for sure. And as you probably heard, folks, that Barbara's training and experience, it's very vast. She's in psychology, medical research, and nutrition. So she has a really unique background for helping you to tackle it all, the mental, the digestive, all of that, all at once, your overall health, and really get you the information you need. So we'll have her web address. It's DR, so it's Dr. DR, Barbara Bolen, BOLEN.com, for more information about this, if any of this has piqued your interest. Thank you so much for being on Life Interrupted Radio today, Barbara. You've just been fantastic wealth of knowledge on a topic that, you know, we don't hear too much about.
Well, thank you so much for having me, because there's so many people who are just dealing with this and they're so lost, and I just want to have the message be out there. You don't have to be lost. You're not doomed to your IBS. Help is available.
Oh, I'm glad you bring that up, because we said at the beginning, it's something that we're just sort of shy to talk about. I'm amazed at how many people actually do suffer from it. So I'm glad we were able to bring you on so we can shine a light on it, that you don't have to suffer with IBS anymore.
Oh my goodness, wasn't Barbara fantastic sharing about what I'd like to say our dirty little secret? No longer does your IBS need to be a secret. No longer do you need to suffer from it. Reach out to Barbara if this resonated with you. And If the Life Interrupted radio series on autoimmune has resonated with you, please join me over at Facebook at Life Interrupted Radio. It's Facebook.com/Life Interrupted Radio, and share with me what you've learned, what you'd like to learn, and anything else that you'd like to know about autoimmune. I'm really enjoying this series and look forward to keeping it going for quite a while now. It's been my pleasure to be part of Life Interrupted Radio in your world, and I always say in closing, go make it a great week, whatever your adventures. Be sure and join me here next week for another episode. Enjoy, and I'll talk to you next week.
The information provided on lifeinterruptedradio.com is for educational purposes only. What you hear, read, and see on Life Interrupted Radio is based on experience only. The information presented here should never be used for any legal, diagnostic, or treatment purposes. Always seek sound legal, medical, and/or professional advice regarding any problems, conditions, and any of the recommendations you see, hear, or read here on Life Interrupted Radio. You've been listening to Life Interrupted Radio. To learn more, listen to other shows, and gain free resources that can help empower your life, be sure to stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com. This episode is brought to you by mindfulnessinactionbook.com. To get your free 4-minute guided meditation to relax, refresh, and renew in just 4 minutes, and who doesn't have 4 minutes? Stop by mindfulnessinactionbook.com now. This guided meditation is in handy MP3 format, so you can use it anywhere, anytime. Download it now at mindfulnessinactionbook.com.
Do you want to be a better leader, have better relationships, become more self-aware, be a better communicator? Hi, I'm Sharon Saylor, best-selling author, professional speaker, and executive coach. And my life passion is empowering professionals to be the best that they can be. After years of working with professionals, I've discovered the 7 things nobody is telling you that can cost you your clients, sales, and even your career. And I want to give it to you free. You've heard my show, you know my passion, and maybe we'll be working together sooner rather than later. So go grab this ebook now to find out the 7 things that's costing you big time over at SharonSaylor.com/radio gift.
This is the EWN Radio Network.